address at this point how we use the AYP. We'll also be able to touch on attendance rate at that point as well, that within our schools. And then I'm going to talk about the levels of consequences for schools and districts. They're a little bit different. Who's responsible for the implementation of those consequences in schools and districts is different, and I want to address those issues. Look at Alaska results from 2003 to the present. 2003 is the first year we did adequate yearly progress for every school in the state. Previous to that, it was just Title I schools. And then I'm going to end by addressing an application that we have with the U.S. Department of Ed to use individual student growth in our AYP calculation and be able to answer any questions about that.
Senator, we'd like to have you come up here and where you could be shot at easily.
No, that's fine.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry, Les.
That's fine. Adequate yearly progress is calculated for every school in the state, every district in the state, and then the state itself is evaluated. And the way the district is done is it's just taking all the students in all of the individual schools brought up to the district level, and for the state it's taking then all the students in the entire state and taking a look at how do we do as a whole state. Some of the basic requirements is that we have participation rate evaluated, so we evaluate every school and actually all the subgroups to make sure that they're getting the students in to take the test. On the test day, we evaluate the school to determine did 95% of the students take the test on test day so that they're not leaving any groups out. And then it's progress toward meeting academic targets. And the target is how many kids need to be proficient in the school is the target. So it's the percent proficient in the school on the state test. And we look at both language arts and mathematics. The federal law requires you evaluate reading in Alaska because in state statute it speaks to reading and writing for our Alaska accountability. We do language arts and we combine reading and writing. So we meet the federal law, we meet the state statute of also including writing. And the target is called the AMO, it's the annual measurable objective, but I'll try to make sure I use both terms as I'm walking through here, because often just saying it's the target of how many kids you want proficient makes much more sense. And then we also evaluate school graduation rates and attendance rates. And the graduation, well, I'll wait till I get to the graduation rate. This is the AMO, or the target. So you can see in 2001, 2002, when you look up on the chart, we required that 64.3% of the students had to be proficient in language arts. And in mathematics, it's 54.86. The way the law is set up is you have to have six increments, so we have had 64.03 for 3 years, then we move up to 70.03, which is what we're at now. That has to increase within six increments up to get to 100% by 2013-14 under the federal law. And so in the beginning years, it was designed so that you would build more capacity in the schools to get to these targets, and so it's 3 years for each increment. But to hit the six increments, you'll see that by 2010-11, every year it increases and to get to the 100%. When we're evaluating overall or adequate yearly progress, we're looking at the overall school, how did the whole school do, and how did the whole district do. We also take a look at how did all of the subgroups within the school do. So we look at how did Caucasian students do, how did Alaska Native students do, and they all have to meet the targets. We also look at students who are economically disadvantaged, how did they do? Students who are identified as limited English proficient and special education. And we then, after we've looked at the academic targets, we then look at what's called other indicator. For Alaska, it's the graduation rate and attendance rate. And let me just talk about how these are calculated a little bit, and if you have questions around either graduation or rate or attendance rate. Feel free to ask now, or you could ask at the end, whichever you're most comfortable with.
Yeah, last question for you. On the ninth grade part, we allow students to stay in school until they're 20, is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, they're allowed to stay, I believe it's until they're 20. Is that correct? 19. Excuse me, 19. Unless they're in special education, they can stay longer. And so it's through their 19th birthday, and they can stay in school and be funded.
Right. I guess it may be technical, but if we're the milestones from the ninth grade, but you can stay after that and you're still in school, how do we describe that person? As a dropout?
We call them a continuing student.
Okay.
If they're...
But technically, they fall into the dropout category.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, yes. They are treated as a dropout in the graduation rate.
Okay.
But if they graduate, then they're counted, they're credited to the school if they graduate, even if they don't graduate within the four-year time frame.
Okay. Good. So. Good. Thank you.
Maybe I can go into a little more of an explanation about that, how the graduation rate works. What we do is we take the number of students who are in ninth grade, and what we're looking at is how many of that number graduated 4 years later, because the law requires an on-time graduation rate, and it would be hard to argue that on-time is anything other than 4 years, because the majority of our students graduate in 4 years. And so what we do is we take the number of students who graduate, and then we look at how many did not graduate because they dropped out, either in 9th, 10th, 11th, or 12th grade. And if they dropped out twice, and that does happen, a student will drop out in 10th grade, return back to school, and 11th grade, for some reason, they drop out again. We only count that dropout against the school for this purpose one time. If they, because they got the student back in, we're not going to count against them for that. So if they dropped out in 10th grade and 11th grade, we're only going to count the 11th grade dropout time frame. And then any student who doesn't graduate on time and is a continuing student counts against them on that fourth year. But if the student graduates in their fifth year, it is a credit to the school, and they get credit for that. So the student didn't graduate on time, but the way our formula works, we're tracking the size of the group graduating, not necessarily the individual student, even though we track who those individual students are.
What if they were to graduate later? Is that still?
If they graduate, they can graduate in a sixth year or at any point that they graduate, they will be credited toward the school.
Right.
Yeah.
Senator Thomas, yes, please.
Chairman. You say you track the number, not the name?
Through the chair.
Maybe I'll make it clear. If John drops out and he's replaced by Bill from somebody coming in from outside, does that not count as a dropout?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, yes, that does count as a dropout. What we do track individual students. We have a unique identifier that tracks them. And so we can figure out, are the numbers that are dropping out, who are those students? So that when a student, here's an example of when we track and it helps a school. Let's say John moves from this school to a school in another district, but the school where he left, they don't know where he went. We can find them with our tracking system and say, no, you reported John as a dropout. He really isn't a dropout. He transferred to another public school, and he's enrolled. And if they get a new student in, they have to be held accountable for that new student that came in as well. So we do track the individual students, but when we're running the actual formula and we've tracked all those individual students, we're really working with the numbers at that point. But we know who those kids are.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Les, that brings up,
Senator Hearns?
I'm sorry. That brings up an interesting question. I've read over time Anchorage, at least in the daily news, is portrayed as having a relatively migratory student population. Theoretically, if you're in Diamond High School for 3 years, on the fourth year you go to Service High School, but you don't graduate, who gets credit for not graduating?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, The last school that they were in is the one that either gets penalized or credited for either they graduated or they did not graduate. I don't know what we have here. Put that away. And so that's how worked at the piece in the dropouts. I just wanted to clarify, there's two different calculations. The dropout is used to help figure out the graduation rate, but the graduation rate is not a dropout rate. The reverse of the number of students that graduate. Let me give you an example. Statewide, we have about a 60% graduation rate. That does not mean that 40% of our students dropped out. They are in that 40%, but also in that 40% are the continuing students who are not graduating on time, or perhaps special education students who may in fact go until their stay in school until through their 21st birthday. And so that doesn't mean 40% of the students dropped out when you hear that the graduation rate is 60%. Again, they're in there. We also, in addition to producing the graduation rate that looks at those dropout numbers and incorporates them into the formula, we produce a yearly dropout rate. And the yearly dropout rate that we produce is looking at how many students that were in grades 7 through 12 drop out. And that is produced because it's in state statute. It actually isn't something that is in the federal No Child Left Behind. We produce that and publish that as well, and schools are required to produce that. And that dropout rate ranges. In the last few years, it's been 6%. In 2005, 4.9% the year before that, 5.4. Back in 2001, it was 6.2. So it tends to range in that area between, about 6 and 5% of the students in grades 7 through 12 dropped out that single year. And it's different in another way from the graduation rate. If you remember, I said in the graduation rate, if the student drops out in 10th grade and 11th grade, we only count when they dropped out in 11th grade. This dropout rate, this is how many dropped out this year. So if that student dropped out in 10th grade, it's going to be for that year's dropout marked as a dropout. If they drop out again in 11th grade, it's going to be shown that that student dropped out again that next year, and it's going to be in that formula. So I've at times people who don't have a understanding of the graduation rate and dropout rate will use those interchangeably, and they really are two different calculations, and I just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you, Les. Senator Wolfen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple things. Les, could we get that on a single sheet of paper for you, just what you said?
The description?
And your explanation of the 6.0, the 4.9, the 5.4. And the other thing, if
my parents decide to homeschool me for a couple of years and I drop out after my freshman year, where do I end up where am I classified in this dropout rate issue?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, if you're homeschooled, it depends on what type of an arrangement for homeschooling. If you're homeschooled but not connected to any sort of institution where curriculum's being provided, either a private school or a public correspondence school, then the way the formula currently works is you're considered a dropout. But if you are homeschooled but actually enrolled in a public correspondence homeschool or a private correspondence homeschool, and there's documentation you are in fact attending school, then you are not considered a dropout. You're considered to have transferred into either another public institution or a private institution.
So could you use an example, if I'm Johnny and I drop out, given Alaska, give me an example of what a public correspondence course is. What's the difference between the two, and use examples.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Wilkin. we have, I believe it's 9 statewide correspondence schools. Galena has one, Delta has one, and so that would be an example. So Johnny might be a student in we often refer to as a brick-and-mortar school. They're going to Zontakini Middle School down the road here. And they decide to do homeschool, but they enroll their student in one of those statewide correspondence homeschools. That would, in fact, be a transfer to another public institution. in terms of private institutions that have that similar arrangement, I don't know how many or if we have any at this point, because the private schools in Alaska do register with us, but the way it's established is it's a voluntary registration. They don't have to. But there could be, just the same as there's these public homeschools, private home correspondence schools, where you in fact are doing your work from home in that correspondence school. So Johnny might be enrolled in a private one. If it's a recognized private school and he moves there, it would be a transfer to a private school, would be his code for leaving the public school system.
And would that person that goes to the private school be listed in the dropout or not?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, if it's a recognized private school, that's an established private school, that's not a dropout.
Okay. So you have a list, of course, of Galena and Raven and Delta and those. So that one's clear. Cool. And then there's another list of some sort, something called a recognized private correspondence.
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator curriculum. Wilkin. Yeah, we do have a list of those that register with us. But if the school where the student left, mm-hmm, documents that, in fact, here's the records request that we received. The student went to this private school, and we know that, and they can show that, in fact, it's a school. We would count that student as a transfer. But if they don't have a records request for that student's records to a school, it has to be, you know, a recognized public or private school, then we'd have to count them as a dropout, because we wouldn't have evidence they're actually, mm-hmm, in school.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Les.
The attendance rate in Alaska is calculated also as part of adequate yearly progress, but it's only for those schools where a graduation rate would not exist. A middle school, an elementary school, for example, would not have a graduation rate. And in that case, the school has to meet a target for the attendance rate. Our attendance rates in Alaska generally are around 93% to 94%. There are some that are lower. Typically, they're not. It's very unusual to be under 90% for your attendance rate. And that's just looking at how many students you have on the books for membership versus how many days did those in membership attend school. And that, again, is part of adequate yearly progress. It's also something that's required in the state statute and for the school report card. I wanted to show you this particular piece. This is the kind of information that is put together to say how did a school do. And this is just an example school. And this is, we have actually a more detailed report that we put on the web about every school, every district, and the state that looks like this. And so if you look over here, we have school as a whole. And this school that we're using had 538 students in the school. Participation rate, they met, so it would be 95%. They had at least 95% of their students take the test. They met. They had 80% proficient in language arts, the target being 70.03. So they've met the target there. Mathematics, they've met the target. Then we do that same for every subgroup. All the ethnic, racial subgroups, and then the three special population subgroups of economically disadvantaged students with disabilities and LAP students. In this case, look at the number. Did 95% take the test? Did they meet the targets? You'll see I bolded this number right here, 50%. In this case, students with disabilities did not meet in language arts. And that was the only group of all of these that didn't meet the targets. And this is probably one of the concerns that we have about No Child Left Behind, and that if in the reauthorization that we have, we feel there should be some adjustment, because we do have schools that miss in one single target area like this one. And then we'll have other schools that miss in nearly all of these or in 18 of the targets. And under the current law, they're treated, both of those schools are treated the same, where in fact this particular school probably needs very targeted assistance with students with disabilities, but they ought to be treated perhaps in the consequences differently than a school that misses either in all the subgroups or in the majority of the subgroups. And so potentially in a reauthorization of the No Child Left Behind law, we would hope to see something where there is a tiered set of consequences. If you're missing in just one subgroup, you still have consequences, but they're targeted to meet the needs of that subgroup and bring that subgroup up to the target, versus if the whole school or a number of them miss in categories. And then you'll see in the last column it says, did they meet the graduation rate or attendance rate calculation? And our graduation rates, as I said, in the state is 60% is what our state runs at, and then the attendance rate generally runs in the 90s. The target is at least 85% for attendance. Most of our schools miss that if they, or make that. If they miss that, they really do probably need to work on some issues there. The graduation rate is 55.58%. Generally at the statewide level, we're meeting that, but there are districts or schools that are not meeting that we have to work with. For AYP, there are a series of consequences based on the level, and the level is the number of years you've missed adequate yearly progress. For school adequate yearly progress, the district is in fact responsible for ensuring that the school implements the appropriate consequences. They do put together school improvement plans. The school improvement plans are reviewed at the district level. The school improvement plans are sent to the Department of Education, and they are reviewed at the Department of Education. There are a series of levels of consequences. If you're at level one, it means you have missed adequate yearly progress for the first time. Level two, you've missed for two consecutive years. And at that point, there starts to be a series of consequences to try to push for improvement in the school performance. And it goes up to level five at the most severe consequences. We don't have a beyond level five, but we do have schools that have been at level five for multiple years. To be removed, once you hit level two and beyond, to be removed from the list of consequences or the set of consequences, you have to show that you meet adequate yearly progress for two consecutive years. The law assumes that if you meet 1 year, that's a good thing, but you're going to have to show that progress for two consecutive years to, in fact, not have consequences, so that, in fact, if the school just met for 1 year, but it was some unusual circumstance, that will be continuous improvement before they are removed from those set of consequences. The district is...
Senator Harkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last, Title I schools. What bearing does it have if I attend a Title I school and I'm labeled Title I this year, next year, based on, let's say I'm a level four or whatever level, and next year I'm not a Title I? What bearing does that have on consequences?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, the title, whether you're Title I or not Title I, actually does have a significance on the consequences. The federal law requires that the consequences apply to all Title I schools, not to non-Title I schools. We could apply them to non-Title I schools, but we don't. So there's a number of financial consequences as well as things that the school would have to do. All schools that are level two or higher in Alaska have to do a school improvement plan to lay out what is it that you're going to do to improve your performance. But there are some financial consequences in terms of the amount of money they have to set aside from Title I dollars for either school choice, being able to go to another school, or supplemental services, which may be after-school tutoring, and staff development. Those impact Title I schools. So if you're Title I this year and you're not Title I next year, when you are at whatever level you're at next year, you will not have those financial consequences. You still will do a school improvement plan. You'll still submit it to your district. You'll still submit it to the state. But you won't have the financial consequences attached.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
At the district level, things are just slightly different, but one of the significant differences is the state is responsible for ensuring, I meant to put district there, I apologize. The state is responsible for ensuring that the district implements the appropriate consequences. There are four levels. for districts, again, same structure. Level one means they missed for 1 year. Level two, they've missed for two consecutive years. Three and four, it's that many years that they have missed adequate yearly progress. The same situation is that a district would have to meet adequate yearly progress for two consecutive years to be removed from the list of consequences. I'm going to go over next some of the results that we've seen in AYP since 2003. This is school results. In 2003, 42% of our schools met adequate yearly progress. In 2004, it was 58, 2005, 59, and 2006, 62. Do want to point out that between 03 and 04, there was a change in some of the rules that we used to calculate. So some of that change is due to the rule change, but I do believe some of that change was also due to improvement. I think the rule change probably would have impacted about a 12% gain. So had it just been the rule change, it would have been my estimate that we would have been gone from 42 to somewhere in the area of 54 meeting, just because of the rule change. It was just how some of the subgroups were treated. No rules have changed in the adequate yearly progress in terms of the calculation from 04 to 06. So that's based on the same set of circumstances for the calculation. This one's a little bit more complicated. Let me walk through and make sure I can explain it well. This is the percent of schools that missed in language arts or mathematics by subgroup. So what we know here is that 19 points in 2004 at the school as a whole level, when we look at how did the whole school do, we had 19.7% of our schools miss adequate yearly progress because of the performance of the whole school, all the kids combined. We also know that in 2004, 2% of our schools did not meet adequate yearly progress because of the performance in language arts or mathematics in the African American subgroup. You can also see then how that happened for all the subgroups and then what changes occurred in 05 and 06. And it's another way to look at, well, are fewer schools being identified for the performance of some of the subgroups? So let's take a look at our limited English proficient student population. By the way, I only used 04, 05, and 06 because earlier I said in 03 the rules changed, and I thought it would be more make more sense just to use the 3 years where no rules changed. So in of our limited English proficient students, we know that in 2004, 13.3 of the schools in the state missed the target for language arts or mathematics, or perhaps both. 2005, that was 9.7%, and last year in 2006 that was 8.5%. So you can see the performance of each of those subgroups in terms of how many schools missed in that area.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Economically disadvantaged. As I understand the rules in our state, unless you're a Title I school, you do not know who the individuals are that are economically disadvantaged.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, we actually have a state regulation where the schools are supposed to identify whether students are economically disadvantaged using the criteria that exists for the free and reduced lunch program. So a school that has a free and reduced lunch program, they have that information readily available for their students. A school that doesn't is supposed to use some methodology to determine who would, in fact, qualify for the free and reduced lunch program. And one of our districts uses, they survey all their families, and they use that information for multiple purposes. One of the purposes, you know, might be athletic scholarships, those kinds of things. So they, even if they don't have a free and reduced lunch program, they still are supposed to use the criteria to determine how many students are in that subgroup based on that. And we do track that at the department. We've had places early on that were indicating they didn't have any free and reduced lunch students, any economically disadvantaged students. And so I would work with the district to make sure they knew that they needed to figure out a way to identify them. And there are districts that have methodologies, and we share those with the other districts. So they are, even though they don't have those programs, they still need to identify those students. Right.
So let me more directly, if I'm a teacher, I know who the economically disadvantaged students are in my class.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, as an individual teacher, you wouldn't, because there is a confidentiality around that. I guess you would if it's 100% of the student population in that school are economically disadvantaged. Other than that, if you were in a classroom, there's 30 students, you're not going to know if they're, you know, there may be five in there that are economically disadvantaged.
Right.
You won't necessarily know that, because that's considered confidential family information, unless there is a reason for that teacher to know that information. And so it really, this particular piece is designed around looking at how is that group doing, but they're, because of the rules around confidentiality and family protection of information, there is a limit of what.
Yeah, I'm not questioning the rule, other than statistically, it looks like it'd be pretty important for the teacher to know who they are if that's a group we want to work on.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Huggins, if there is a reason for the teacher to know that information, and it might be that the school has a program where they offer a scholarship for students who are economically disadvantaged to do something that might otherwise cost students within the school setting, there may be a reason that the teacher and the principal would know that to be able to offer that to that particular family. Outside the rules are pretty restrictive on the confidentiality around that information. But I think you point out one of the challenges people have is that you're right, you want to see that the performance of that group improve.
Is there an equation that allows a family to waive the confidentiality?
I think the main piece in the law is that the family knows everything that's released.
Right.
That's what FERPA, which is the law that I'm speaking of, it is that the family needs to, in fact, know everything that's on file at the school about their child, and that the family knows about any release of information. Mm-hmm. So I believe, I'm not an expert in FERPA by any means, but I believe if the family shared that information with the school, that certainly would be okay.
Yeah, but I mean, because for obvious reasons, some of those categories, you just look at the person and you know which of those categories they go in. The economic disadvantage cuts across those, and some you couldn't tell. But I don't want to beat a dead horse. It just appears to me that systemically that would be one we want to chip away at a little bit, so the teacher knows the target audience. But anyway, thank you.
Well, that's a very important question. Can you use a definition, an easy definition, simple definition of economically disadvantaged, not real complex, but
it's just meeting the income eligibility for free and reduced lunch. So every year there is we produce a chart that says if a family is of this size and this is their income that they have, they fall under the poverty line, and then they are therefore they would fall in this category. And each year that format that is updated every year. So we have a chart that we produce every year that lays that out, and it has family size.
Thank you. Senator Wilhelm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are the intensive needs students in the disabled line, or are they spread through all the lines by ethnic background?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, the disabled students, the intensive needs would fall in the disabled population, and they would fall in whatever other category they're in. So students actually are in multiple categories. If it's a Caucasian disabled student, they're in the school at the top, they are in the Caucasian subgroup, and then they're in the disabled subgroup. So these students end up in multiple subgroups.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. This is a little harder to read because I pulled this from some documentation we have. So, and hopefully it copied well for you on your charts, and I can provide this in another format if this is hard to see. But what I wanted to do is just show the difference from 2004 to 2006 in terms of how many schools missed in how many categories. Let me explain that a little bit better. Remember on that chart I showed you about adequate yearly progress in that school that missed in just one category? Well, that school would be represented in the top line there where it says number of categories not meeting, one. We had in 2004 53 schools not meeting just in one category. In 2006, we had 72 schools not meeting in just one category. I think that where that becomes significant is we're seeing that schools are hopefully addressing the needs of some of those subgroups because fewer of the subgroups are becoming identified. And again, I did not go back to 03 because the rules were slightly different in 03. I just looked at 04 to 06 where the rules are the same. And you'll see in 04, if you look at the number of schools that missed in eight categories, it was 46 schools. Mm-hmm. You look in 06, you're going to see overall fewer schools are missing in that many categories. And so as another way that we've tried to look at, are we addressing the needs of some of the subgroups? We're not hitting, you know, there may be still subgroups that are missing, but is it fewer for the different schools? It's just another way to look at, you know, improvement in the districts, in the schools. I want to switch to district adequate yearly progress. And again, the way the district adequate yearly progress is done, we take how did all the students in the individual schools perform when you add them all together for the whole district. So with Anchorage, we're adding 92 schools together, all the kids in the 92 schools, and looking at how did that district as a whole do. This is the results from this past year. We have three of the districts that are at level one. Eight of the districts at level two, means they're in district improvement status one. So they have missed for 2 years in a row. 10 schools missed for 3 years in a row, and 11 districts are at level four, which is corrective action. Two of those 11 have been at level four for 2 years, and two of those 11 have been there for are on their third year for being there. And so their level of consequences is more severe depending on what level that they're at and how many years they've been at level four as well. I want to switch, and this is the last topic, then I'll take other questions, but I want to talk about Alaska's desire to include growth in adequate yearly progress. And I can just jump back here a little bit to a slide. I'm going to jump back to here. When we look at how did this school do, how many kids met in adequate yearly progress for the school as a whole, 80%. If this was the worksheet for an elementary school that had through grade 5 in it, that would be how did the students this year do who are in grades 3, 4, and 5? And then next year, we're going to look at how did the students the next year do in grades 3, 4, and 5. And we know that two-thirds of those are very different students than they were the year before because the fifth graders are now have moved on and a new group of third graders have come in, or one-third of them is completely new. We've lost the fifth graders. We've got a new group. So it's comparing different groups of kids this year to a different group of kids the previous year. Alaska has had a long interest, actually, in looking at individual student growth. How did Johnny do this year compared to how Johnny did last year? And what we would do is we would take a look at when that fifth grade group went on. We don't care that they're now in a middle school and they're in a different group. How did the middle school do with them as sixth graders compared to how those students performed the previous year when they were in fifth grade? And Alaska was building an accountability system to look at this before No Child Left Behind. And so we have been pressing the U.S. Department of Ed to allow us to look at growth. And we have an application with the U.S. Department of Ed asking to do that. So again, how much did the kids improve in their performance, and actually individual students? So we've applied to the U.S. Department of Ed. We will find out whether we have been successful in our application to include that individual student growth by April of this year. the way things would be different is we'd still do adequate yearly progress just the way that we do it right now, but we would also run a growth check on all the schools and figure out, did any of them meet because students actually improved performance? And an example or a graph that sort of explains the need for this, in our view, is on this on slide 15. And look at school A and school B, and let's assume we've just aggregated all the kids into that school and looked at how they performed. And we found that all the students in school A in year two, they actually showed a decline in their performance compared to this, that same group of kids when we track them back to the previous year, regardless of actually where they went to school. We find where that kid went to school and look at how did they do in this school this year compared to how they did in whatever school they were in the previous year. And did that school in year two improve that student's performance? In school A, the performance actually declined. But under the current model, well, they're above the AMO or the target, so they meet adequate yearly progress, even though the school, the student's performance has declined. In school B, somewhat of an extreme example, but we you can potentially see these types of things where the students increase dramatically in their student performance, but they miss the target, and so they don't meet adequate yearly progress. And we don't believe that that makes a lot of sense. If they've improved that much, there is something happening. We ought to recognize the school and try to help it show that kind of a gain again so that one day they do meet that target. And so we have a proposal before the U.S. Department of Education asking to include growth. We've had dialogue with the U.S. Department of Ed since about May of 2005 working on this. And so we hope that we have success in including this as another indicator, not not completely replacing the system that we're using, but as a way to enhance what we're doing.
Mr. Chair, my assumption is misspelling would understand the significance, and we've probably had a conversation at some level with her. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, we've had conversations with her. She has put out she's actually invited states to apply for growth models, and she's limiting the number of states. The department is limiting that to 10 states would be able to pilot a growth model. I believe to date the department's approved 4 of those models. 4 or 5, we're hoping to be one of the 10 that are approved. And we've had direct dialogue, the commissioner and I, with the deputy secretary, and so it's something that they're supporting looking at. We do believe their rules are a little more restrictive than what makes sense for a growth model, but we continue to make our points on that. And I think they do understand it. And then I'm open for any other questions. That's the presentation. I'd be happy to answer other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. That's very, very comprehensive. Any questions anyone has at this point? Senator Huggins?
Just your opinion, Les, minus your job, just as a person of statistics.
If you can separate those.
You can do those two.
Yeah.
It appears to me that if you go around to a few states, one of the commonalities you see is a common language, and AYP as an example. So you could say that is movement. But overall, as far as the system, school systems, school districts, states, moving in a positive sense for education of kids, is AYP, No Child Left Behind, has it made a difference?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins. I actually do believe it's made a difference, and you see some gains up there that we've seen overall, but we now have really very clear sets of expectations at every grade level that we didn't have before this law, and the law pushed that you'd have to have that, and it makes sense. If you're going to test every grade, you got to tell people what is it that we're going to test. And I think there's any time in the past that Alaska or probably any other state, but particularly Alaska, hasn't been clear that we expect students by grade 4 to know this set of information, by grade 5 this set of information. It's very clear, it's published, a lot of staff development happens in districts so that they have that information, what they are responsible for teaching, and knowing that that's what we're going to be looking at the end of every year to test those students on. I think that's probably one of the most significant things, is it's the picture is much clearer than it was in the past. And that's true probably in every state. And I think that's probably the most significant gain that we've seen.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, one more question, please. You know, I've read quite often that No Child Left Behind is grossly underfunded. And then I've heard some people in smaller conversations say, no, it's just there's a different mechanism in a lot of cases called grants, where you got to apply for them, and they're targeted grants for things. Are either of those accurate or both inaccurate?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I'm not sure I'm the best one to answer those questions. And I don't know. There are a number of people from the department. I don't know if there's you want to respond? The deputy commissioner is here, but I don't know if there's a clear answer on that.
Okay,
particular
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. Senator Wilkin, did you have a
question? If I could,
please.
If we could look at your charts, could you go to chart 4? I'm intrigued. What's the significance of the 0.03, and why isn't it 0.01 or 0.05?
What we did was, it's the methodology that is used to set this up. You begin in the first year by figuring out what's called the 20th percentile, and you figure out where is the student who scored at the 20th percentile across the state. We literally took, 90,000 students, took the lowest scoring student to the highest scoring student in the state, and figure out which kid is at the 20th percentile. And that, then we look at what school that student is in. And whatever the percent proficient in that school was, that's the starting point. And then you have to just, you basically lay out a formula to walk that up to 100%. So why that ended up at 03 across the years doesn't make a lot of sense to me, frankly.
Why wouldn't it just be 64, 70, 76, 82, 88, 94?
Well, in some of the schools, that little bit of difference, because we actually take it out to that level when we're looking at how many were proficient in that school, and that number becomes significant in whether they're over or under. And it may be just a little bit, but it is significant for them hitting the target. There's no question in 2013-14, of course, but before that, it.
Very interesting.
Interesting. On chart 7, please. What's an LEP student?
I apologize for using an acronym. It's Limited English Proficient Students, and we have about 20,000 Limited English Proficient Students in the state of Alaska.
20,000?
About 20,000.
And number of students if less than 20, so, greater than 20. So if there's a ethnic class, I don't know what one would be, but if there's an ethnic class that there's only 10 students in that school, are they embodied in the school of the whole number, or do we just not measure them?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, every student is embodied in the school as a whole. Yeah. And when I say there's that minimum N of 20, actually, that is not true at the school as a whole, because we measure every school. So if the school as a whole only had 10 students in it, they're going to get measured at that school as a whole no matter what, because we have an obligation to measure the performance of every single school regardless of size. But any of the groups, any of the special populations under school as a whole, if they are under a certain number, we only use that information as a reliable indicator of how they did if they meet that number.
All right, thank you. And then slide number 12. So this seems to be a really powerful chart to show our progress, I think. The goal here would be to have 2007. The number of categories not meeting would of course be the list, and then number of schools would be zero. So in a perfect world. So we've gone from 04 through 06 from 276 schools to 190, or if my addition's correct, or close. So we've taken approximately 86 schools off the list. Is that fair to say that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, that is fair. Every one of the schools should be represented in this chart.
Okay. So do you have any expectation of, I mean, that's that slope has to start to level off. Do you project that? Do you know, do you have a goal for where that number will be in 09?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, I guess we haven't established an exact goal, but I would hope to see the same type of trend continue if we're going to meet the targets that are required in the law, and that you may see more missing in 1, 2, and 3, but that we, you know, have far fewer in those upper levels, at, you know, missing in 4 categories, those types of things, than anything above that.
Yeah, well, two things have happened. They've taken 86 off the list, and then the rest of them, the mean has gravitated up. So it's happening. Correct. I mean, it's really two wins.
Correct.
So, that's a really good chart.
Yeah, we produced this. We just found this interesting, and then we, as a result, started producing it every year, thinking it was another way to look at the progress of how schools are doing.
Might throw that on a graph, and it's a little more visual, isn't it?
Yeah.
Last year, and in the budget process, you had a list of the schools that were in the 4 categories.
Mm-hmm.
It might be helpful if you give that to the committee, and it just shows, it gives you a sense of where some of the problems and challenges are. In our emails a day or two ago, we got from we received from Donna Foxley, the NCLB, No Child Left Behind coordinator for Alaska, a whole multiple attachments, and I didn't even print them out. So it might be helpful for you to look at those and tell us which ones are the most important, and let Senator Stevens know, and we'll print those out. And to that end, this is a huge year for renewal of No Child Left Behind. So is Ms. Foxley going to come and talk to us, and how are I know you're in contact because you've already talked about that, but is there some role that this committee or this legislature can play to encourage, cajole, do something to help our state in this very important renewal process?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, I'd be happy to have discuss things at the department and then get back to you on the role that the committee might be able to take. And there certainly will be components that we will want to stress with our congressional delegation that are important in terms of changes. We've had dialogue actually very recently with one of our U.S. senators' offices as they're looking at changes in the reauthorization. And I think that sort of a united voice from Alaska would be very, very helpful. And you know, we've had great interest actually in this growth component, and would like to see that written into the law that is allowed for states. And that's one thing that we've pressed real clearly on. We also think there's some needs for some changes with highly qualified in terms of teacher quality that would make sense for Alaska that the current law doesn't. And so I think if the department has some time to analyze the documents that recently came out from the U.S. Department of Ed, I have not read all of them yet myself, but they are on my reading list, and has a chance to continue that dialogue with this committee, I think that would be useful.
Yeah, thanks. Mr. Chairman, I think that this would be the committee to do that, and we don't need to get down to the 0.03 level, but mm-hmm. we certainly, if you gave us the big three that you would want the legislature to ring in on, I think it would be perfectly appropriate for this legislature to speak to the federal government about what we think is important to help you work through this, because we'll be sitting for another 5 or 8 years before we get another bite at this apple, and we do have some challenges. Regardless of what they might say, we do have to do it differently in Alaska sometimes. And this is the time for us to say something, and I think a resolution would be perfectly appropriate. And I think it starts right here if the department and Ms. Foxley and we want to do it. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wilhelm. For the questions or comments? Yes, sir. Senator Hargan?
Two things. Number one, I would like to thank Les and the department for doing this for us. And my motivation for being on this committee is to make a positive difference, to be able to help. So any way that that's possible, I invite you to help me help. If I could ask you to go to page number 11 on your charts and just simply ask you, when you look between Caucasian, Hispanic, and Asian, you can see for yourself, particularly in 05 and 06, the numbers there. The Hispanic and Asian achievement in Alaska, doing well, it appears, in comparison to other peer groups. Is that tracked nationally?
It is tracked nationally.
The correlation between Caucasian, Asian, and Hispanic, we're an aberration in that respect?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I would have to analyze that. There's part of what you're seeing, particularly with Hispanic, I believe, is that they're it's a small population within our state, and so in many cases, the Hispanic student population may in fact be under those minimum ends where we measure them. If they're a real small group within a school, we don't measure them as a group by themselves, while we do measure them in the school as a whole. I would have to take a look at some performance indicators on assessment in our state for all students compared to information that's available through the National Assessment for Educational Progress to see if it tracks exactly the same. I don't think this is a comparison to that. I'd have to do some other analysis, and I could do that.
Yeah. And my final question has to do with the business of the system. All systems can be gamed. And it appears to me that, at least looking at this on the surface, the easiest one to game incentive-wise would be 95% attendance versus dropout. It would be to your advantage as a manager of a school site to take somebody off the rolls instead of having to go for 95% when you know that person's not going to show up maybe. I don't want to belabor that point. Do you have any concerns about those kinds of things and negative incentives that work against the kids potentially?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I think one of the pitfalls in a law this complicated is you can game it. And what I've tried to do is look at the ways that people might game it and do analysis. And so what we've done on that particular piece is I take a look at how many students were there on the first day of testing compared to how many students were there on October 1 when we begin our October count for funding, and figure out if the drop is more dramatic than what it is in the average of the state, to see if a school looks like they are losing a lot of students and why that's happening. You see those kinds of things when you're looking percentage-wise in very small schools. A couple of kids shift the percentage. I'm not talking about that. I'm looking at the bigger schools. And so we're looking for those kinds of things. And at this point, I haven't seen people in Alaska, any of the schools, doing that kind of gaming from that analysis. Not in any way that I felt like I need to follow up with the district at this point.
Good.
Thank you. Further comments? Any questions or comments from the audience on this issue? Anyone care to speak at this time? Well, thank you, Les. I really look forward to working with you in the department. I think there's some issues here that are extremely important to the state. And it's really good to see some of the charts and the impact that No Child Left Behind has had, areas that I think we can help out here. So I look forward to working with you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. There's nothing further coming before us. So you have our schedule. You know that on Wednesday we'll be doing an overview of the foundation formula and not meeting on Friday. Thanks very much.
You plan on passing the bill out on Wednesday?
Why not?